How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 17 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head on to iTunes and search Locked On Thunder to subscribe to the podcast. You can leave a review there as well. Hopefully it'll be 5 stars. That would be nice. No solo podcasting today. I've got a guest. It's a real live human being for the first time in a couple of episodes from the internet. The first ever returning guest on the pod, Sam Vecenie.
How's it going, Fred? I am proud to be the first returning guest on this podcast. It is a privilege to be here.
It's a big deal.
It is. Like, I feel like I am breaking ground on the Locked On Thunder podcast right now. Like, I feel entirely special right now. It's a tremendous, tremendous honor.
Are you going to put that in your Hall of Fame plaque?
I might put it in my Twitter bio. Like, that's even more of like a Hall of Fame plaque move. Like, that'll just be like sitting there for everyone to notice.
Twitter bio is a big deal. People talk about what kind of hat people wear in their Hall of Fame plaque. Like, what kind of hat you wear in your Twitter profile is a big deal.
No joke, man. I mean, it's where you signify your places of employment. It's where you signify anything you want people to know. And I just demand that people know that I am a dual Locked On Thunder guest.
Mark Cuban like talked about that last year after DeAndre went back to the Clippers. Mark Cuban said one of the things he would have done differently if he could do it over again is he would have made DeAndre change his Twitter bio.
I don't even know how to attack that. Like, I mean, I feel like once you're talking like a 4-year, $80 million deal, Twitter bio goes out the window probably.
Hey, not according to Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban would have changed his Twitter bio. There's so many things they could have done differently. Number one, change the Twitter bio. That's what you got to do.
Oh, my God. Man, Cuban, you know.
Whatever. Great. I love Mark Cuban.
Great for the league.
Oh, he's the best for the league. He's so good for the league. He pours much money into the league and gets it so much publicity.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, a lot of people don't realize that, like, Cuban genuinely, like, revolutionized the league in the way that he treats his players. Like, it's almost a given now that, you know, people around the league and fans expect like players to be pampered and expect them to have the highest class of services given to them and afforded to them by these organizations. And Cuban was really the first one to do that. He upgraded every single aspect of the Dallas Mavericks whenever he got to Dallas. And I think that it's definitely a change that has helped to benefit the league. And I think that it helps to benefit the image of the league. You know, Cuban is, you know, a lot of people can say what they want about Mark Cuban. That guy is a genius businessman. And he doesn't seem like a outwardly bad guy to me by any means. He's always, anytime that he's walked by me or anything, he's always smiling and he's always very polite to everyone around him, around the league. So I know you're not going to hear me say too many bad words about Mark Cuban, I don't think.
I like Mark Cuban. I find him entertaining. He's clearly a bright human being. I find him entertaining. He's also helped with a lot of advancements in the medical, you know, workings in the NBA too. Like with the way that they compose their training staff or the type of guys that they have, with the way that they've incorporated injury analytics and not just on-court analytics. That's a team that's really helped advance that. Look, like they stole Casey Smith, who was an assistant trainer with the Suns. They poached him to come over to Dallas. They're one of the only people that take – I mean, the Suns are kind of known for having the best training staff in the league universally. And I've always wondered why – there's no salary cap on trainers. I've always wondered why some team who doesn't have a ton of money hasn't just said, all right, when your contract is up – because Robert Sarver is not necessarily known for paying more than any other owner in the league. Why some other owner hasn't just made – you know, an offer to the people on the Suns training staff being like, okay, we're just going to give you twice as much money. Come to our team right now. And no one's really done that, except Cuban did take their assistant trainer, who is now their head trainer in Dallas. And Dallas is kind of known as having one of the better training staffs now, and Casey Smith leading the way. So that's another thing that Cuban's done, which I think deserves to get – it deserves a lot of credit. And that's another reason why Dallas, I think, is comfortable signing older guys and moving forward with Dirk, and how Dirk is still so good because they've been able to find success in kind of injury prevention and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, no, from what I was told around the league, kind of Phoenix's training staff doesn't necessarily have the cachet that it used to have. It's not like this hyper elite, crazy staff that is, you know, extending the careers of everyone involved. I think that they're kind of still living off of that reputation, even if it may or may not necessarily be true at this stage. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, a way that and you see this a lot in baseball, actually, I think, where, you know, teams try and find these little advantages on the margins. And, you know, in the NBA, at first it was analytics, and now it's, I think, medical training. I think that you're going to start to see more and more in terms of teams trying to exploit the littlest edges, the littlest margins, and trying to, you know, maybe overpay for those in ways that aren't capped by the NBA and by the CBA. And, you know, try and improve your organization that way. It wouldn't surprise me if all that, if that's the direction we're going.
This is so inside baseball right now.
That's the goal here. I just spilled coffee all over myself, by the way. So that's
okay.
I have the whitest of white t-shirts on, and I just spilled coffee all over it. So we're off to a rip-roaring start on the Locked On Thunder podcast.
I was recording a solo podcast when I was in Vegas for Summer League last week, and I accidentally spilled a mojito on my computer. So right in the middle of recording. So that was – we've had some graceful moments.
Can we talk about Las Vegas really quickly? I mean, you know, Fred Katz, I got to tell you guys, Fred Katz is the world's foremost authority on Capriotti's subs. I mean,
oh, that's true.
He is probably I haven't listened to all of the Locked On Thunder podcast, but I feel like Fred has to have mentioned, you know, just his adoration for Capriotti's subs at some point, right?
I'm not sure if I have. I just learned that there was one in Oklahoma City, which is unbelievable.
Yeah, no, Fred is seriously, like, Capriotti subs, if you're listening to this, in Oklahoma City, Fred will not only advertise your product for, like, 5 minutes on the podcast, but, like, he will wholeheartedly endorse it in every way that you can imagine. He will eat there. He will incorporate Capriotti's probably into the Locked On Thunder logo if the creator of the Locked On Thunder podcast network, the Locked On Network, will allow him.
That's all true. What we're advertising for it right now, it's so good. The Thanksgiving sandwich is so good.
See, the problem with that is that, like,
there's no problem.
The only problem with it is it tastes incredible. I agree, but like you just want to go to sleep after it. And
yeah, that's not if a you're problem. Going to, that's if wonderful.
If you're going to Summer League basketball, I made this mistake last year. If you're going to Summer League basketball and you have one of those things, there's no way that you're making it through the day at Thomas and Mack. Like, it's just not happening because your body is just going to totally shut down by, you know, like maybe 6 o'clock.
My body shuts down anyway in Vegas. It might as well be from a huge turkey sandwich as opposed to any of the other substances I could put in my body. I think those mojitos are going to shut me down at some point anyway. So I might as well get shut down prior to them by a Capriotti's Bobby or some other. The turkey there is just particularly good is the thing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, all of the food there is particularly good. I got a cheesesteak while I was there because I always stay right across the street from Capriotti's at the Hard Rock. That's personally my favorite hotel in Vegas because it's off the strip and you can find a way to get away from the action while still kind of having the ability to go down and gamble if you want. So I live right across the street from the Capriotti's subs place in Vegas whenever I'm there. And it's difficult not to just drive by and make a quick stop in and grab something. It's pretty great, actually.
I do have one complaint about Capriotti's, and then we'll actually talk about the Thunder after this. But I do have one complaint about Capriotti's. Why?
I don't believe you.
Why are you stopping serving breakfast at 10 a.m.? That's so early.
Move it
to 11. I got into Vegas that first morning, landed at 9:50, went straight to Capriotti's, got there at like 10:20, went to get a bacon, egg, and cheese, get a breakfast sandwich, not serving anymore. Yeah. 10 o'clock is really early to stop serving breakfast. Got to move that to 11.
Well, it's particularly early in Vegas, too, like where everything is basically 2 hours behind the rest of the modern world. So, yeah, no, Capriotti's does need to extend that out, I think.
Yeah, that's too early. Anyway, let's talk Thunder, because we actually have Thunder news to talk about. The Thunder did something. For the first time this offseason, there's actually news that won't depress Thunder fans. They signed someone. They actually signed someone. It's the first guy they signed this summer. Alex, I'm pretty sure I pronounce it right, because I've written his name and read his name about 400 times, and I realized I've never actually heard it spoken. I assume it's Alex Abrines. No relation to Gilbert Abrines. But Abrines was the Thunder's second-round pick in 2013, 32nd overall. Now, after spending the last few years with FC Barcelona in the Spanish ACB League, he's coming over to the NBA. Three-year, $18 million deal. Eurohoops.net was the first to report that. Sam, I know you've seen Abrines play a little bit more than I have. I've gotten to watching him a little bit today. I've heard about him about a gazillion times. I feel like I know his stats off the top of my head at this point. What are your impressions of him and how he could translate to the NBA?
Yeah, he went at the top of the second round in the 2013 NBA draft. He was an interesting guy at that stage. He wasn't quite like the prospect that he is now, commanding a 3-year, $17, $18 million deal or whatever it was. But at that point, he was considered, you know, like a solid project worth investing in. He was pretty creative, could do a little bit of stuff, had a nice jump shot, or at least a nice looking jump shot at the very least, had some athleticism in there. But since he's moved to Barcelona, he's improved his game by leaps and bounds. He's become just a tremendous shooter from distance. In his 718 three-point attempts over the last three seasons at Barcelona, he's shooting 40% on the nose. He's a tremendous decision maker. Doesn't really ever make a wrong read necessarily. Like, he's the kind of guy who's not necessarily the most comfortable player at attacking closeouts yet. And I think that that's kind of the next step in his game. He needs to kind of improve it. Once a guy closes out on him hard and creates that space for a guy like a Russell Westbrook or whatever, he needs to be able to make that play either via the pass or via attacking off the dribble into the pass to kind of, you know, create rotation, create or putting the defense into rotation at the very least for the opposition. So I'm going to be interested to see how this whole thing goes. Like I said, not a bad athlete, not necessarily an elite athlete by NBA standards, but he's a solid athlete. And like I said, like, this is a kid that at 22 years old was, you know, a halftime or not like starter half of the time, not halftime necessarily, starter half the time for one of the deepest teams in the world outside of the NBA in Barcelona. So that's not something that should be ignored. And like I said, 3 years, $17, $18 million. I mean, that's the kind of deal where you know that he was a big money player over there because you have to invest a good amount in his in him to get him over to America. So you know what kind of player you're getting in terms of the intelligence, in terms of everything he can do. And I'm going to be interested to see how this goes. I think that I would be surprised if he totally fails at the very least.
Something that I'm wondering, and I don't know if you necessarily know the answer to this one, but I certainly don't. Pretty much all the film, all the examples of him that I've seen have come in the last couple of years. The last couple of years, he's basically a run off of screen guys. He's catch and shoot. He shoots from the wings. He shoots from the corners. He's not necessarily putting the ball on the ground as much. I mean, he's pick and rolling and that kind of stuff every once in a while, but he's not necessarily shooting off the dribble or creating shots for himself very often. His role is pretty much catch and shoot, which it seems like that'll be his role in the NBA, which it's nice to be able to have that sort of, you know, that sort of congruent switch to where you can kind of come over and do the same thing in the league, play the same role as you did with a former team. A couple of years ago, when the Thunder drafted him, one of the knocks on him was he's not a shooter. That was part of why he went in the second round as opposed to the first round. But when he was drafted, as of 3 years ago, I mean, he was shooting 10, 13 percentage points lower than what he's shooting now from three. He was 18 years old then. Now he's 22. Or maybe he's 19 years old then. Now he's 22. So is there a reason that you know of that he's shooting junk? Did he change form? Did he just hit 20 years old and all of a sudden he started shooting? Because not all 19-year-olds can shoot. And you get examples like Drew Holiday, who shot poorly in college, and then all of a sudden he gets to the league and he's a good three-point shooter. And certainly even more extreme examples than that, who, you know, I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. Is he just one of those guys who was a little bit of a late bloomer as a shooter? Did something happen with his form?
Yeah, my guess on that is that he was either going through some sort of injury or confidence thing back in 2012 and 2013, because kind of early on in his career, I mean, he was kind of known as a shooter. Like back in the 2011 U18 championships, he won the MVP of that event. You know, he shot 42% from three. You know, playing for, you know, the first few teams that he played for, Malaga, he shot like 38% from three, I believe, something like that, 36% from three. Like this is a kid that has had the reputation of a shooter, but struggled to shoot the ball a little bit coming into his, you know, season and a half before his draft year. So I'm not entirely sure what the cause of that was necessarily, but you know, the mechanics from what I've known have always pretty much been there. It's been more of a situation of you know, he's just kind of finally showing it.
I've gotten mixed reviews on him from people I've spoken to around the league today.
Mm-hmm.
What have you heard? I've heard that he's a good shooter.
Yeah.
That his release might need to be a little bit quicker.
Yeah, I can see that. I think it's probably okay, but I can see that at least.
Or at least maybe a little bit higher, which is just something I've noticed. His release is a little bit low, but that may not be an issue. If he's a really good shooter, that's, you know, not the biggest deal in the world. The bigger concerns I've heard are, how is he going to adapt defensively? Because there are concerns about his athleticism.
Well, it's not just his athleticism. Like he has like a little bit of bounce to him. He's not like I'm trying to think of someone who came over from Spain and was just like incredibly slow off, like slow foot speed wise. I don't think he's that necessarily. What I'm a little bit more worried about is that he's still really skinny. I don't know if he's going to be able to take like the pounding of typical, you know, NBA wings. He's the kind of guy that I think might get overpowered a little bit defensively more than, your traditional, like, oh, he's too slow to guard the pick and roll, or he's too slow to do other stuff. He's just very skinny and he might not be powerful enough to kind of, deal with the rigors that the NBA kind of puts you through, especially over an 82 game slate.
Yeah. I mean, look, here's the big thing with him and just the act of bringing him over. The Thunder are desperate for shooting. Like they really, really need 3-point shooting. And if he can shoot anywhere near to what he shot in Spain, he can contribute right away. I mean, just as a 3-point shooter.
Yeah, I think that he's going to be able to do that, to be honest. I mean, like I said, like this is a kid that I don't even really see the release point problems, to be honest, like you did. Like, I think that he's going to be fine in terms of the jump shot, maybe a little bit quicker, but that's not stuff that, you know, concerns me heavily at this stage. It's all the other stuff around his game, whether or not he's going to be able to attack closeouts well enough and create enough plays, whereas before he's just mostly making the right decision in terms of shoot pass. And whether or not he translates defensively, I think, is going to be the big one. But, you know, overall, you know, 3 years, $17 million, or is one of those an option year for the Thunder?
I don't think we know that yet. It's 3 for $18 million, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, if one of those is an option year, it wouldn't be a surprise to me by any stretch of the imagination, just knowing the way that NBA teams try and kind of make these contracts work and try to set them up. So it wouldn't be a shocker there at all to me if that's the way that this thing goes down. But, you know, we'll see whether or not he's able to carve out a role early on. I would almost expect him to do so, because he does something different than all of the Thunder's wings currently. I mean, Victor Oladipo, Andre Robertson, you know, I guess Anthony Morrow's a really good shooter, but Deion Waiters may be back. Like, yeah, I think that he at least brings something different and is worth the investment for the Thunder.
Yeah, I do think this might put a halt in Deion Waiters coming back. I think that's something to think about.
Well, did they withdraw the qualifying offer?
No, they didn't withdraw the qualifying offer, but I would be surprised if Deion took the qualifying offer.
Yeah, I mean,
if I were Deion Waiters' agent, I would not advise him to take the qualifying offer. Players who take the qualifying offer should be consistent players who know that the money will be there the next year as an unrestricted free agent. I don't think Deion Waiters falls under that category. Deion Waiters could come out and have a bad year and end up not getting as much money as he could get on the open market.
Yeah, but I mean, I largely agree with that. But the thing about Waiters' qualifying offer is that it's actually pretty big. So you know, he could actually make more money on the qualifying offer than he might be being offered around the league right now. So maybe if he thinks it might just be worth a 1-year deal to try and rehabilitate his stock in some capacity, do you do it for another team or do you do it for the Thunder making, you know, a lot of money on the qualifying offer because he was the 4th overall pick. So I think that the question is at least there in terms of whether or not he could consider taking it.
I don't think Deion Waiters' market is as low as people think it is. I think just because he's gone, I think a lot of the time we think guys who go late into the summer are bound to lose money. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. Going late into free agency is not synonymous with not getting big offers. A lot of times we see guys go late. I mean, look, Miles Plumlee signed 4 for $50 today. Like we see guys go late and sign. Like Eric Bledsoe is a Rich Paul guy, so he went late, but you know, he still got 4 for $70 or whatever it was. And Tristan Thompson got paid, and Nikola Pekovic got paid, and Enes Kanter got paid. I mean, all these guys went into mid July, in August in some cases. Tristan Thompson went to September. That was an exceptional situation because he was holding out with you know, weird stuff with the Cavs and disagreement, and everyone knew he was going to go back there, and it was a weird situation. So maybe that's exceptional. But these other guys, other restricted guys, have gone late and still gotten paid. I think Deion Waiters is still going to get paid. I don't know by whom. I don't know if it's going to be by Oklahoma City or by Brooklyn or by Philadelphia, but I think Deion Waiters is still going to make money.
Sure, but I guess here's my thing, because if you're going to offer a restricted free agency deal, I believe it has to be at least, is it 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to get years.
You think he's going to get years?
Yes.
Well, I guess, yeah, I mean, the thing is for me, like if you're offered, you know, a 3-year, $30 million deal, if you're Waiters, or, you know, you can take the qualifying offer at right around $7 million and then go back into free agency at a higher cap number where still a lot of teams are going to have money, I might consider it if I'm Waiters. I don't think it's at least insane to kind of think that maybe my long-term value could be a little bit better.
No, I don't think it's insane. I just don't think it's necessarily worth the risk because Deion Waiters could come out and shoot 38%. And then get a lower contract this year. He could come out and just kind of be upset with what happens. Because I think some of what's happening is that Deion Waiters' reputation around the league is not pristine. Now, I will vouch for Deion Waiters on a personal basis.
I like Deion Waiters a lot. The thing with Deion, too, is like if you know one dude that's going to bet on himself, who's it going to be?
Right. That's true. That being said, if Philly comes at him with an offer, maybe he wants to go home. He's from Philly.
Yeah, entirely possible.
And, you know, maybe you know, if Philly comes at him with an offer, if the Nets come at him with an offer, maybe he wants to go there, get a lot more playing time, probably start.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing, too, though. I mean, in Oklahoma City, he's still going to get like 30 minutes a game next year. Like, the 1-3 situation in Oklahoma City right now, you're talking like Russ, Victor Oladipo, and then like Robertson, Cameron Payne, Anthony Morrow, Singler, like Josh Eustace, like guys like that. Like, I think that you're still talking about a situation with Waiters where he's probably going to get 30 minutes a game next year. So I don't even know if playing time is going to be an issue, right?
Yeah. When I say that, I misphrase that. I should say at least he's going to touch the ball more.
Yeah.
He'll touch the ball more in those roles. I mean, look, I think Deion Waiters is still going to get money. I would not advise him taking the qualifying offer and holding out more. I just don't think he's the type of player that does that. Look, not many guys have done it historically anyway. Greg Monroe went really late into the summer as a restricted free agent, took the qualifying offer. Part of that was because he just wanted out of Detroit for various reasons. Ben Gordon did it. Ben Gordon was a consistent player who you kind of knew was going to come out and have a good year. Deion Waiters is inconsistent on a night-to-night basis. He's inconsistent on a month-to-month basis. And he could be inconsistent on a year-to-year basis. And if Deion Waiters has a down year for whatever reason, if the questions that were about, you know, look, Deion Waiters is a model citizen in Oklahoma City. But there were questions around the league about, you know, how he was in the locker room and that kind of stuff in Cleveland. And fair or not, because he was, by all accounts, a model citizen in Oklahoma City. Fair or not, there are teams that wonder if, you know, that's something they would have to worry about, and that's a thing. So if something like that arises in this up next coming year, and he could be costing himself money, if I'm someone like Deion Waiters and I've got a possibility of $30 million on the table, I would just – that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money, and I would take that money. I would not be upset if I were Deion Waiters making $30 million. That is a pretty good amount of money. I love working at the Norman Transcript. I really do. I'm not just saying this publicly. I have awesome editors, and I work with awesome people, and I love covering this team. But if I got $30 million, I'd be gone. I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
much.
Yeah. I mean, there's a difference though with Deion, where the potential is there for
he can make
60. You know, he can next year he could legit make $60 million on the open market with a good year though.
You think there's a difference? You don't think I can make $60 million on the beat for a team in a newspaper?
It's 50-50, Fred. I'm not sure.
I don't know. I think my ceiling's pretty high.
One of the questions I have for you, kind of going forward too, is, if you're the Thunder, would you hand Steven Adams a max now?
Oh, without question.
Okay.
In a heartbeat. I wouldn't even – yeah. I agree. Of course. He's really good.
No, I know. I mean, I guess the question is, like, do you just max him now and then, you know, deal with the, you know, lessened cap space? But, you know, their cap sheet is so open next year that I would think that I would rather just have Adams under at the, you know, 4 years, $85 million or whatever his maximum deal is. I think it actually might be a little bit more than that now. But yeah, like, I think I would just rather have him at something like that.
Yeah, for sure. You can get him for less. Yeah. I would lock that in for sure. They're going to sign him to a max deal next year. Something would have to go catastrophically wrong for them not to sign him to a max deal.
I guess there's just not really a whole lot of intrinsic value for them to like offer him the max now. You know, like, what if he gets hurt? I mean, what if, I guess that they should just be offering him less than the max right now.
Right. I mean, you know? Look, I understand it. And you know, it's not like they have to worry about losing him. Any possible offer sheet that he signs, they're going to match on. He's a really good player. He doesn't have an injury history. He's only getting better. He's 22 years old. He was awesome in the playoffs. And he looks like he's going to be an all-defense caliber center. I mean, and that has offensive value on top of that. Like, how many all-defense caliber centers that are plus offensive players are out there? He's going to get the max either way. You could hold out if you wanted to. I don't think it would be the worst move in the world. But if Steven Adams came at you, I mean, look, I think part of this is also from a culture perspective. Like, I know that sounds, sometimes the numbers are, sometimes you got to go by pure basketball. But sometimes I really do think that the culture perspective is both overrated and underrated. It's overrated when guys get big contracts to come in and be veteran leaders when you can have veteran leaders on minimum deals. It's underrated when we talk about this kind of stuff as treating your players right and getting them the money and that kind of stuff and building up a culture where players are happy and they feel appreciated. And I do think when you're in circumstances like the Thunder are in right now, I think building up a spot where your players feel appreciated and are happy with that kind of stuff, I think that has value. Yeah. So if Steven Adams needs that to feel appreciated, and this is me projecting, I don't know if that's true. We're talking about in the hypothetical scenario where they feel like they need that. If Steven Adams feels that they feel like they need to give that to make sure, hey, Steven, look how much we value you. Here's your max contract. Go take it. And if Steven Adams wants to sign that before the season starts when he's eligible to extend on his rookie extension, then I'm cool with that.
Yeah, no, I think that it's an interesting discussion. Even if you offer him something like, you know, $490 or something, I don't think that's a slap in the face to him. I think it's just like this is a realistic assessment of your market value, and we really, really want to keep you. And if you go out and get max next summer, we will match. But you know, we want to offer you this now. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't negotiate as such, but like as far as the thoughts going through the Thunder's head, I can see that. I can see something like that being a legitimate discussion going on in their front office.
I want to talk also about let's get away from the Thunder a little bit, but it's not Thunder related, but there is a lot of overlap between Thunder fans and OU fans. So let's talk about a little bit of Buddy Hield, 6th overall pick in the draft by the Pelicans. Of course, former Oklahoma star, former player of the universe, according to most Oklahomans. It's true. You can look that up. Buddy, I edited his Wikipedia page to say that. Buddy missed some shots in summer league. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Buddy struggled a little bit.
He's played better in his life. That's certainly true. What were your impressions? I mean, I'm always one to I don't believe in judging players off of made and missed shots in summer league. I think that's a dangerous game to play. If you make a lot of shots, you're not good. If you miss a lot of shots, you're not bad. It doesn't actually matter. The process of how those shots happened and what types of shots you got off is probably more important. Now, even if you played really well in summer league, that doesn't necessarily mean you're good either. I tend to believe the only thing we can really take away steadfastly from summer league is if a guy is just absolutely horrific and it looks like he's not going to be able to play and he's getting just like pushed around and he can't physically compete, then maybe you start to have reservations about a guy who you originally thought was good. But that's to me like really the only way that I can think like maybe this guy's not really going to be something, because if you see a guy who dominates, like, he could just be Josh Selby, you know. Buddy missed shots. In my opinion, I didn't really see that many concerning things from Buddy that I didn't already know. What were your thoughts on his summer league?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to someone who, you know, I've written tens of thousands of words on Buddy, and that's not even an exaggeration, you know. Like, I've talked to him for, you know, probably an hour on the record before, and he's just an awesome dude. And, you know, I'm someone that I think is inclined to root for Buddy Hield. I do think that there are some concerns in terms of the separation he was getting, and like, for his jump shot and for finishing around the rim. Obviously, the shooting numbers weren't great, but a lot of that was just kind of missing wide open shots. I remember there was a moment, I want to say there was something like 6 minutes left in the third quarter of, I think it was their last quote-unquote regular season summer league game. And Buddy had like a wide open three with no one within 15 feet of him, and he missed it. And I don't think I've seen Buddy miss a shot like that in a year and a half now. So I think part of it is just kind of overcompensating for the moment, and this being his first NBA experience and him wanting to make great impressions on everyone around him. I can see that being something that weighs on his brain a little bit. Overall, though, like you said, it wasn't like such a disaster. It wasn't like a Nick Stauskas performance where you're wondering whether or not this guy is an NBA player. Buddy looks like an NBA player. He can get his shot off. It's just the kind of separation that he's getting is a little bit worrisome. And I think that that's always been the worry, because he's not a great ball handler and he's not this elite athlete, but he is a pretty elite shooter. So you would assume that eventually some of the shots that didn't fall last week are going to fall going forward.
Yeah, I mean, something else that you have to take into note when you look at summer league, I mean, the stats are honestly totally meaningless. You can have an on night or an off night shooting. Basketball is not about whether you're making or missing shots. It's about the process behind those shots. That's true at any level. That's why it's important. That's why it's important to see good offenses that take corner threes and that take shots at the rim, because more often than not, they're going to regress to what NBA players shoot from those percentages, and you want to, you're taking good shots, and your process behind those shots are normally good shots. You're taking a lot of corner threes, normally it means you have decent ball movement. You're getting the ball in the middle and kicking out, because you're not dribbling into corner threes. I mean, that's why people talk about these being important statistics. It's not just because like the corner three is closer, so it's better. There are reasons behind this. Now, summer league, I think that's even more important because of the style of competition you're going up against. And something that you have to take into note when you look at Buddy Hield's numbers too, the Pelicans were not using him in the way that I think they're going to be using him regular season. I mean, he was playing a lot more like he did at Oklahoma than he will in New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans, I think they're going to be playing him off the ball a lot more. He's not going to be handling as much. That's going to be Drew Holiday's job or whoever else. Depending on, you know, if Drew Holiday's on the floor, and obviously Anthony Davis is going to get the vast majority of the looks over Buddy Hield because he's Anthony Davis, deservedly so. I think Buddy Hield is going to be a solid NBA player. And I think a lot of it is going to have to do with the fact that he's probably going to be a really good catch and shoot option. And playing in Alvin Gentry's offense, Alvin Gentry has historically been really good at developing guys who are kind of Buddy, what the type that you want New Orleans to turn Buddy Hield into. You know, I know you've talked about before is, you know, his strength is not necessarily running off screens, finding openings, that kind of stuff. But Alvin Gentry is really good at coaching stuff. JJ Redick attributes a lot of his development in that area to Alvin Gentry. Now, JJ Redick was good at that before. Now he's unbelievable and led the league in 3-point percentage last year. And part of that is because he's so good at getting open off screens now. It's unbelievable to watch. You know, he was there for parts of Klay Thompson's development in Golden State. You saw that in Phoenix with the way that they moved off the ball. I think he'll be a good fit for Buddy Hield in that sense in the offense. And I think when Buddy is used more like that in the NBA, he could end up looking a lot better for it.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you just said right there. I think that, I think the NBA is a little bit more of a make and miss league than you ascribe to it being like a more of a process versus results oriented thing. But in summer league, especially, it is a lot more about the process than the results in some ways, just because you do want guys that can, you know, at least create open shots. And if they fall, they fall. If they don't, they don't. Buddy was creating solid looks. Some of the shots just weren't falling. So
I will take that to the grave, by the way, that in basketball, regardless of the level, if you take good shots, now good shots can have different meanings. Like a good shot is different for different players and is different in different situations. But if you can open up good shots consistently, then they will eventually fall in. I am completely convinced of that theory. And
I mean, yeah, I mean, Andre Robertson, I think, is begging to kind of make that theory a little bit rough now.
Well, no, good shots are not, they're not true on the whole. You sound like Barkley right now talking about, yeah, that's
no,
not,
I mean,
it,
you
it
know me,
on
I
the
am,
player. A good shot, is, look, a contested three for Steph Curry is often a good shot. Like a contested three for DeAndre Jordan is often not a good shot. So like,
yeah, but like an open three for Andre Robertson based on percentages kind of isn't really a good shot. But the Thunder kind of need him to take those shots, though, because it messes with their spacing if he doesn't. So I don't think it's as simple as saying like it's a process versus results thing, because at some point you do need the results to reflect the process. But I understand your point still. I'm not going Barkley here, too.
If I could have Barkley on the pod, then I would. If Barkley could be a returning guest, that would be something.
Now that'd be weird, but I get your point.
Getting
into
some analytics debates with Barkley.
Oh God, that's just a problem. I get your point, but I think that, you know, the roles that teams need players to play often kind of clouds the process versus results thing, and to a point shifts it to more of a make or miss league.
Maybe I'll make this the last word so we don't keep talking in circles.
Yes.
But I will say that. I think it really does depend on the player. Like you bring up Robertson, for example. I think his role by definition makes that, even if, you know, it's a 34% shot when he's open or whatever he shoots on open catch and shoot threes, which is not a great percentage. Even if it's, you know, a 34% shot or a 33% shot or whatever it is, the reverberations that has on the rest of the defense turn that into a good shot. So I'm not saying good shot necessarily on what the points, the expected points per possession is on that shot. No, basically saying the effect it has on the defense.
I know what you mean, but Robertson, I mean, we saw in the playoffs what kind of problems he was inflicting on the Thunder offense, though, even just by being on the floor a lot of the time. So I get the idea, but it's not as simple as that to me.
Fair enough. Sam, anything else you have to say about Buddy Hield? Anything you want to plug? Anything else you want to talk about before we go?
You want to talk about Summer League a little bit? Because I wanted to ask you who you think the best player was at Summer League this year. Because I have like kind of a weird answer, I think, given that this guy wasn't on either of the NBA's like two teams that were released, like the all Summer League teams that were released. But, you know, I really liked what this guy did. So who, before I say who mine was, who do you think was the best player at Summer League?
You go. Give me a sec to think.
I think Trey Lyles was the best player at Summer League.
Yeah, I mean, Trey Lyles was really good.
It's either him or like Devin Booker. Devin Booker was really good as well. But Trey, I mean, like everything that you want from a guy like that, he knocked down some threes. He rebounded well. I think he averaged something like 23-9. So like, I know that stats in Summer League are somewhat meaningless, but like if you're dominating competition to a point where you're putting up like 23-9 on you know, offense that seems reasonably efficient for you to create in the run of play in the NBA, I really like what he was able to do within the context of that terrible Utah Summer League team.
I'm into it. Trey Lyles is going to be a good player. Utah's going to be good. UCOC win 50 this year.
Yeah, I think that Utah probably will win 50 this year, but that summer league team they put together, I mean, I get it, because no one putting together a summer league team is not easy. And, you know, I think that directors of scouting deserve a little bit more credit for having to deal with that craziness, because, like, you know, agents want the best situation for their scout, for their players. And, you know, with Utah, they have so many, you know, guaranteed contracts and guaranteed roles that, you know, what's the point in going to play for Utah's summer league team if they're not going to bring you on in the regular season? You're basically playing for another team at that point. So why not just go to that team where they can get an up close look at you? So I get that. I understand why Utah's team was bad, but man, was that team just not fun.
You want to hear, you want to hear my guy?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to say Emmanuel Mudiay.
I didn't see him when I was there. Was he good?
I think he's really good.
I mean, I had him ahead of D'Angelo Russell on my draft board. So, like, I am in on Emmanuel Mudiay. I just didn't see him while I was there.
Yeah, I think he's really good. I mean, he was so good in the second half last year. I mean, he was so inefficient in the first half of the season. Yep. That I think he kind of fell off people's radars, and he was playing for a 30-some-odd win team in Denver, so he kind of fell off. But him and Jokic last year were really good. Like, those are two really legitimate pieces that Denver has moving forward. Those are both really, really good players. And I know I've talked about Jokic and Mudiay a lot in the podcast, for this being a Thunder podcast, but those guys are good. Like, those guys are going to be really good players. I think at least one of those guys could end up becoming an all-star one day. Like, Mudiay is athletic. He's not the most, he's not Russell Westbrook athletic, but sure, he's a really good athlete. I think he's really learning how to survey the floor. I thought he became, like, look, his efficiency numbers rose, but it wasn't necessarily because he became such a great shooter in the second half, or he added moves to finish around the basket. I think he was just more comfortable with the speed of the game. Like, you could tell it was really fast for him. He played in China. The Chinese league is, It's
garbage. Just say it. It's garbage.
There is sketchy stuff that goes on there too. Like, it's just, yeah, it must be hard to scout coming out of there.
It's bad.
Yeah, and Mudiay is, he by pretty much every single account, the game was too fast for him coming out, which is fine. I mean, he's young. He would be a sophomore in college right now. Like, that's okay that the game was too fast for him his first half of the year. That happens to most rookies.
Yeah.
So that's fine. He was shooting like in the low 30s% from the field. He was super inefficient, and he looked pretty overmatched, but I thought Denver did a good job in just keeping him out there. I thought that was, I mean, not that they had that much to lose, because it's not like they had a team that they thought was going to contend, but I thought that was, they did a really good job of making sure he stayed out there. The second half of the year, I thought he gathered himself a lot more. They took a little bit of the, you know, they took a little bit of the dribbling off his hands. They didn't put as much pressure on him. They didn't put as much of the offensive burden on him within the offense. Jokic, because, you know, making a huge jump in the second half, I think helped him a little bit too. And I thought Mudiay just made better decisions. He started passing better, started finishing better. He looked more comfortable with the speed of the game. He anticipated teams' rotations better. I think he's going to be good. I thought he played really well. He only played in, I think, one summer league game. I thought he played really well. I think he's going to be a strongly, comfortably above average starting point guard. And I'm excited to see what happens with his career.
Yeah, you know what he's always been able to do, even going back to his high school days? He's always been really, really good at keeping the defender on his back in the pick and roll so that he can kind of survey the floor in front of him and make decisions and kind of keep himself going toward the basket still while keeping the guy on his back and keeping an open lane in front of him. It's a really impressive skill, and it's a really difficult skill to learn, but he's always kind of innately had it, and that's always been really impressive to me. And one thing that he mentioned to maybe Matt Moore, our good buddy Matt over at CBS, he said that, or one of the coaches said maybe, that what he struggled with was just like how he has a stronger dribble now. And by stronger, he like understands like just how low to the ground he has to keep it, and how he has to get the ball to like bounce back up to his hand. Instead of doing it lazily, he has to do it like, you know, pretty firmly so that he actually keeps a strong dribble, so that he can keep plays active and keep plays going while surveying the defense. That was a really interesting aspect to me because it's kind of a skill that you don't really think about for these, you know, younger guys who may be a little bit physically weak when they enter the NBA, just in terms of like literally how strongly you have to dribble the basketball to keep it, just to keep it active all the time in the NBA. But that was one thing that really struck me, from the things that I've been reading about summer league guys is that, you know, Moutier has really improved in that capacity. And I think that I agree with you. He's going to be an above average point guard this year.
And when people talk about potential Russell Westbrook packages, if the Thunder were to trade Russell Westbrook, if it got to that point where they had to trade him, Denver is a team that can offer a really good one. Now, I don't know if Denver would jump on that because I know Denver right. really likes its young guys and would probably be concerned about re-signing Russell Westbrook and probably wouldn't even do that unless they got a commitment from Russell Westbrook right off the back that he would re-up for some amount of years. But at the same time, Sam Presti will call Denver. That is a phone call he's going to make, and Jokic's name is going to be said, and Moutier's name is going to be said. And there are other teams out there too, Lakers, Minnesota, Boston, Phoenix, who can make legitimate offers that match up with the Thunder's timeline and the Thunder's priority if they were to trade him. But Denver's right there, and if you know those two guys can get pried away, that would be a really big get.
Can Phoenix make a legitimate offer for Russ?
Yeah, they think they can.
I was gonna say, like, I look at what Denver can offer, and I'm just like,
oh, the Denver package is my favorite package.
I think I agree with you because if you could get something, well, I guess that my question is like, if you could convince Russ to renegotiate and extend out just for one more year, I think that makes a lot of sense for him. It's something that you and I have talked about. Like, if you can get him to renegotiate and extend for one more year, he's actually a pretty valuable trade chip for the Thunder. And then once you do that, you're talking more about packages that I think could become viable for Denver. Maybe you could trade one of Moutier and Jokic, or maybe you do like Moutier and Nurkic. I'm trying to think of like other guys, maybe like a Hernan Gomez and
I don't think you want Nurkic.
And,
I don't think you want Nurkic if you're the Thunder. I don't think Nurkic,
not,
I don't think Nurkic goes next to Adams.
No, he doesn't, but I think that if you can find a taker for Cantor, Nurkic, I think, is going to make his killing just eating second units in the NBA. So I don't know that you necessarily need him to work next to Cantor, or next to Steven Adams.
Eating is a good verb to describe it. He would do the second units.
Yeah, no, I mean, he would eat humans in general. I mean, this Nurkic is massive, and he's the run to
the family.
He's like, yeah, oh my God.
His father is the largest human being who's ever lived.
And his dad was like a cop in Bosnia. Like, that would be the most terrifying thing to run into.
His father, actually, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you do not know what Jusuf Nurkic's father looks like, just Google it. And
Jusuf Nurkic's father has the biggest hands I think I've ever seen.
He is the biggest everything. He's so large. He's such a huge man. Anyway, Sam, anything to plug before we head out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to do something on Summer League on Tuesday for Vice. Right now I'm doing regular Tuesday stuff for Vice. I'll have some other stuff out there right now. But I'm going to do like Summer League superlative award kind of things based on past elite Summer League players like Anthony Randolph and Josh Selby and John Wall and Damian Lillard even. Not even just the guys that haven't panned out. So you can go to Vice and kind of look for that on, I think, Tuesday.
Awesome. So look out for that. Sam, Twitter handle?
Sam_Vecenie, SAM_VECENIE.
Very impressive. You can spell your last name. Took me a year to make sure I got that right.
Yeah, it happens. I mean, cats, KATS, right? Something like that. It's like the musical, right?
It's close enough. Before we head out, remember you can head on to iTunes, subscribe to Locked On Thunder there. If you have questions or comments, email lockedonthunder@gmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Fred Katz, FREDKATZ, Sam. Log on to normantranscript.com for all your Thunder needs. And check out Thunder Road. That's my blog there to follow team coverage and what's next for the Thunder. That's going to do it for today. I'm back with you tomorrow. Another non-solo podcast with another good guest. Until next time, Locked On Thunder is locking up.